From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Novelist Isabel Allende spent the better part of a year caring for her daughter Paula, who was in a coma. Allende writes, "Together we crossed a mysterious threshold into a zone of inky darkness. Paula never came out of the coma. She died of a rare blood disease." On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Isabel Allende about how she tried to comfort her comatose daughter. Also today, we meet Kai Ohata, the writer-director of the new film Picture Bride, about Japanese women who immigrated to Hawaii to marry Japanese laborers. The film recently won the Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead, who just returned from Holland, tells us about the Dutch jazz scene. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United States is stepping up its accusations against Iranian terrorism today. The Clinton administration is trying to persuade other nations to follow its lead and cut off trade that could help Tehran pay for terrorism and develop nuclear weapons. Secretary of State Warren Christopher says if Iran gets foreign help, it will be able to build such weapons sooner rather than later.
Iran has been frustrated so far in its efforts to produce weapon-grade material at home. Therefore, it has aggressively sought to buy them abroad. Its agents have scoured the former Soviet Union in search of nuclear materials, technologies, and scientists.
The United States is appealing to Russia and China to cancel plans to sell nuclear power plants to Iran. Russia's rejected several U.S. pleas to call off the deal. The matter is certain to top the agenda when President Clinton and Russian President Boris Yeltsin meet next week in Moscow. The Palestinian representative to the United Nations is calling on the Security Council to take urgent measures to counter Israeli plans to expand Jewish settlements around Jerusalem. Representative Nasir al-Kidwa is warning the move could threaten talks on the status of Jerusalem, which are set for next year. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
In his letter, al-Kidwa says the council has a duty to order Israeli authorities to desist from taking any further illegal measures, and specifically to rescind the declared confiscation orders. At issue is an Israeli decision to seize 131 acres of land within the area of what he describes as the illegally annexed East Jerusalem. He said the Israeli action represents a flagrant violation of Security Council resolutions, as well as the Declaration of Principles signed by Israel and the PLO in 1993. Al-Kidwa charged that the decision to seize the land prejudged the outcome of negotiations. He added that it undermines the peace process as a whole and shatters confidence in the commitment made by the Israeli government. However, Al-Kidwa did not call for the council to formally debate the issue. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Baseball's umpires and owners have agreed to a new contract, ending a four-month management lockout. Since the season began last week, replacement umpires have been judging strike zones. Evan Weiner has more.
The 120-day lockout of the umpires by Major League Baseball is over, as the owners and umpires have agreed to a new four-year deal. The umpires will receive a 25% pay raise and will earn bonuses for work in the All-Star Game, playoffs, and World Series. The umpires expect to be back on the field on Wednesday. Still unresolved is a new contract between the players and owners, and no new negotiations are scheduled between the two sides. For National Public Radio, I'm Evan Weiner in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 8 points to 4,312. Trading is heavy. 273 million shares have changed hands. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq is down almost a point and a half at 842. This is NPR. Rescue workers in Oklahoma City have abandoned their faint hope of finding survivors in the dangerously unstable federal building. Governor Frank Keating says workers will now search for bodies. Firefighters will go on sifting the rubble by hand until heavy machinery is brought in. The death toll now stands at 137, with almost 60 people estimated as missing. Governor Keating says even after the heavy equipment is brought in to find remaining bodies, some 20 bodies may still be buried in the shell of the federal building. The child known as Baby Richard, whose custody case was fought to the U.S. Supreme Court, is now living with his biological parents after being transferred from his adoptive home, NPR Cheryl Duvall reports.
Despite attorneys' hopes to prevent an emotional scene, the four-year-old reportedly sobbed and pleaded with his adoptive parents not to make him go for the first time to the home of Ottokar and Daniela Kirchner. The boy was photographed there later the same day, smiling and playing. The Kirchners had been trying for more than 3 years to reclaim custody of the child, whom the mother had given up for adoption when he was 4 days old. The adoptive parents, identified only as John and Jane Doe of suburban Schaumburg, Illinois, had provided baby Richard with the only home he had known. The case prompted revisions in Illinois adoption laws so that the best interest of the child may take priority. But the law changed too late to affect Richard's case, despite months of negotiations and court appeals. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall.
The new Dutch owners of the unsteady Barings Brothers Bank have fired 20 executives. The ING Group says the officials are blamed for the trading scandal in Singapore that brought down the institution. The Dutch conglomerate had said no one would be let go until British authorities finished their investigation, but ING said the probe is taking too long, and top Barings executives from London, Singapore, and Tokyo have been fired. Barings went broke in February after trader Nick Leeson lost nearly $1 billion through bad trades. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's often said that there is nothing worse for a parent than to outlive a child. In 1992, novelist Isabel Allende lost her 28-year-old daughter, Paula, to a rare blood disease that had left her in a coma for the better part of a year. Allende's new memoir, Paula, is about the months she spent caring for her daughter as she lay trapped in a state between the living and the dead. Isabel Allende is one of Latin America's best-known novelists. Her uncle was the Chilean president Salvador Allende, who was assassinated in a 1973 military coup. After the coup, Isabel Allende worked underground in the resistance movement, then fled the country. She now lives in San Francisco. Her novels include The House of the Spirits and Of Love and Shadows. Her daughter Paula was living with her husband in Madrid when she got sick. Allende flew to the hospital and eventually took her comatose daughter back with her to San Francisco. This is a reading from the days Paula was hospitalized in Madrid.
You have no control over your body, Paula. You cannot move yourself, and you suffer violent spasms like electric shocks. In one way, I'm grateful for your state of complete innocence. It would be much worse if you understood how ill you are. By trial and error, I'm learning to care for you. At first, the opening in your throat, the tubes and probes horrified me, but I'm used to them now. I can bathe you and change your bedding without help. I have bought a white dress and nurse's shoes in order to blend in with the staff and avoid explanations. No one has ever heard of porphyria here, and they believe you will never get well. Your daughter is so pretty. Poor child. Pray God to take her quickly. Patients who are still able to speak tell me. The atmosphere in this room is depressing. It reminds me of a place to warehouse the mad. Do you sense what is going on around you, Paula? I don't know whether you hear, whether you see, whether you understand any of the things happening in this madhouse, or even if you know me. You just stare toward your right, your wide eyes and dilated pupils fixed on the window where occasionally a pigeon alights. The doctor's pessimism and the sordidness of the ward are eating holes in my heart.
It's Isabel Allende reading from her new memoir, Paula. Why did you write this book while Paula was in a coma?
Paula had a very rare condition called porphyria, and sometimes patients fall in a coma, but after being in coma for a week or 2 weeks, they recover completely with no consequences. So everybody told me that Paula would recover. I thought that maybe during that time she may have forgotten things. You know, memory sometimes fails when patients have been in coma for some time. And I thought, I need to explain to my daughter who she is, where she comes from, who we are, all these people around her bed. So I started a sort of letter for her, and the first sentence of the letter is, "Listen, Paula, I'm going to tell you a story so that when you wake up, you will not be so lost." And then I don't know how or why I started telling her my own life, a sort of memoir. And two stories intertwine in these pages, her, what was happening to her during that year, and the story of our life as a family.
When your daughter was in a coma, and the coma lasted, what, about a year?
Yes.
Did you believe that she knew that you were there, even though she wasn't conscious?
I don't know. I don't trust my imagination. Maybe it was just my imagination that sometimes I thought she she could relate to me in some ways. But the truth is that I tried to get a yes or a no from her, let's say by pressing her fingers or blinking her eyes. But there was never really any response. I want to believe that when we took her home and she was surrounded by her family and cuddled by all of us, she was aware of the love, but I'm not sure.
What are some of the ways you tried to reach her?
I tried everything. We would talk to her all the time and telling her every moment where she was, what had happened, who we were. We tried through music. I recorded things and would put it with earphones so that she would listen it inside her head. But nothing really worked. And the only way of communication I had with her, really, was through instinct, intuition, and dreams.
When you had a dream, did you believe that those dreams were an omen or something that was giving you a deeper message?
I had a very significant dream when she first fell in coma. I was living in a little hotel near the hospital, 15 blocks away from the hospital, and I woke up in the middle of the night. I was with my mother at that time. And I had this terrible dream in which the voice of my grandmother told me that Paula had drank the potion of death. And I got up, dressed, and ran to the hospital. And the nurse must have seen my distress because she let me in and I could go into intensive care and see that she was still alive. I think that at that moment, Paula died. Her brain died. And her body went on living, but her brain died. And I did not recognize the dream as a premonition. I denied it. I didn't want to believe that it was true.
Your grandmother was a spiritualist. Did you feel that you had spirits to believe in when Paula was sick?
Yes, and I summoned those spirits in a way. The spirits are the memories. Sometimes I do not believe that the ghosts of the dead were around Paula, but the love, the memories were. And I summoned my clairvoyant grandmother, my sturdy grandfather, and especially Granny, Paula's grandmother, my mother-in-law, who had died 14 years before.
What about the Catholic Church? Did you have any belief that helped sustain you in Catholicism? You'd left the church many years before. Did you have any of that form of faith
I didn't
left?
Go back. No, I didn't go back, but I saw that faith really helped Paula's husband and my mother. So those people who were, who had faith, who were close to some religion, were stronger than I was. But unfortunately, I do not have that.
Paula herself had remained a Catholic, and she had been in a Catholic spiritual retreat before getting sick, and she was volunteering, I believe, at a Catholic school.
Yes. She was very curious about religion, and she was seeking for God all her life. She shared this with me in many ways. She would talk to me and write to me about this, but somehow I didn't pay much attention at the time.
Did you feel like, well, maybe you should summon up more Catholic feelings out of respect for Paula's Catholicism? You know how you sometimes you want to do what you think is right for the person who's sick, and that doesn't mean you can fake any feelings, but you're not sure if you should be trying to believe things out of respect for them.
I didn't try to believe, but I tried to comfort her with things that Catholics do. For example, there was a priest in the hospital, and I asked him to give her I don't know the word in English. In Spanish, is extrema unción, that you give to the dying.
Extreme unction, yeah.
Yeah, and there was always a cross near her bed, and I tried to do the things that she would have done.
You write in your book that your mother was bargaining with God a lot while your daughter was sick.
Yeah, she was always pleading and bargaining and asking God that she would do this if you could just do this for Paula, or she offering her life instead of Paula's. You know, I did the same thing in other ways. I thought that writing was like some magic thing that could keep her alive, and as long as I kept writing, she would be alive. I didn't write in what my mother did in praying.
Paula had a lot of high technology when she was sick. There was neurologists and breathing machines and so on. But you also brought in spiritual healers to help her.
At the beginning, I didn't bring them in. They just came. I don't know how they learned about this, and they just appeared one day, and they started doing sort of psychic or spiritual healing. That I don't know if that helped or not. I don't think it did, actually. But when I brought Paula to the United States, I thought that technology could help her in rehabilitation. After a month in a rehabilitation hospital, they told me that there was nothing that they could do because she had severe brain damage. She didn't have a brain, really. And at that point, I took her home. And then for 3 months, I tried everything, Terry. All psychics, shamans that you can even imagine, herbs, acupuncture, everything.
Did you go through a full range of feelings about whether that approach was helping her or not?
Yeah, hope first. And then slowly you lose the hope because you don't see any change. Fortunately, I had a wonderful doctor, Dr. Sherry Forrester, a wonderful woman, who helped me through that. She somehow allowed me to try everything. And then she said, okay, there's a point when we have to stop because this has to stop at a certain point. You can't go on forever with this. So we decided it would be for 3 months. And after 3 months, she reminded me that we had tried everything and nothing had worked. And at that point, I think I just relaxed and said, okay, I'm going to make Paula comfortable and just love her. And don't worry if she progresses or not.
And during this period, she was home at your house?
During the second part, because the first 5.5 months were in Madrid, and then I took her to California, and I had her at home.
When did you decide that you wanted to take her back home with you to San Francisco?
I decided that the first day that she fell in coma, I was waiting for her to be well enough so that I could fly her home. I had already convinced my son-in-law, who is a wonderful human being, that Paula had returned to the womb and I was going to take care of her and I was going to make her well.
Well, how did he feel about you taking her away from Madrid and bringing her back to San Francisco? Because they were living in Madrid.
He agreed because he knew that he could not do it. He had to work, so Paula would have to be institutionalized somewhere. And we didn't want that. We wanted to be with her and help her through life and death.
Did you ever think to yourself, how long could you take her living in this coma, knowing that she wasn't going to come out of it?
I never thought about that. If she could take it, I could too.
Were you ever worried about the memories of her being in a coma driving out memories of what she was like before that?
That year was very long, and in a way, for a long time after she died, I could only remember her sick and dead. Because after she died, we couldn't find her husband, who was traveling at the time. And we could only reach him the next day, around noon. So for a day and a half at least, Paula stayed at home in her bed, and I stayed with her. It was too long. The image of her body there, already dead and very pale, and that was fixed in my memory, and for a long time I just couldn't visualize her alive. And that year of illness became more important than the 28 years of her wonderful life. But then my stepfather came, and he had put together pieces of film that he had filmed Paula during her life, and he put all this together in half an hour of a wonderful videotape in which Paula is dancing. I'm cutting her hair. We are running in the beach. And then I could see her again as she was.
That's really important, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very important for us as a family to remember her the way she really was.
My guest is writer Isabel Allende. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Isabel Allende. Her new memoir, Paula, is about her daughter, who was in a coma for close to a year before dying of a rare blood disease. Your husband at some point said to you that you're just becoming absolutely obsessed with Paula and that you were beginning to fall off the edge. Did you ever wonder whether you should be spending less time with her or kind of pulling yourself away a little bit? Did you feel you had any choice in the matter?
No, I didn't have any choice at all. I was there to take care of her because I was the mother, and it never occurred to me that somebody else could do it. And what I thought when Willie said that was that I should be more careful with the rest of the family. I should not dump on them all my anxiety all the time. I had to have better manners, really.
Were you with your daughter when she died?
Yes, I was in bed with her, holding her.
Did you try to do things to help?
No.
Ease the death, yeah.
No, because it was very easy. She just started to breathe slowly, and then it took a long time, all day and all night, but she died peacefully. And I was holding her, and somehow it was a strange night. I have the feeling that maybe I was hallucinating, but I saw the room full of people, the dead and the living, hand in hand. My mother, my stepfather, Paula's father, people who were far away, were in the room that night somehow. At the same time, Willie was there, my son and my daughter-in-law, and they had placed the two babies at Paula's feet on the bed. So she was cuddled and held by all of us, by the spirits and the living.
She had given a letter to her husband before she got very sick, a letter that said, "Open this after I die." Did you ever wonder what led her to write that?
We have often wondered what happened. This is how the story goes, how Ernesto, Paula's husband, told me the story. They were in their honeymoon 9 months before she fell ill. At the time, there were absolutely no symptoms of the disease. And she was happy, in love, in her honeymoon, 27 years old. And she had a dream in the middle of the night. She woke up, wrote a letter, put it in an envelope, sealed the envelope with wax, and wrote outside, "To be open when I die," and gave it to her husband. Now, why would she write that letter? I don't know. But it must have been a terrifying dream, a sort of premonition in a dream. I don't have a letter like that. My mother, who is 74, doesn't have a letter like that. Anyhow, after she was sick for a long time, nearly a whole year, I decided to open the letter. That was by the end of November, when I really felt that she was drifting away. So I opened the letter, and the first sentence in the letter is, "I don't want to be trapped in my body." So what did she see in the dream? I don't know. The rest of the letter is a sort of spiritual will in which she says that she wants to be cremated and she doesn't want her name in any tomb, and she wants her ashes scattered in nature, and that is what we did.
Was it hard for you to re-enter the world of the living after your daughter died? Did you almost feel like it wasn't right? Do you know what I mean?
No, on the contrary. I have three grandchildren, and I felt that I was betraying them. They need a joyful grandmother present in their lives. I think it's essential for children to have a grandmother or a grandfather or some older person that can dedicate a lot of time to them. And I was failing them. So I felt that I needed to get through this grieving as fast as possible and go back to life for them and for my husband too. We met very late, you know, and We have been together only for 7 years. Always we have the feeling that we missed so many years that we were not together. So I really wanted to go back to him too.
Writing about your daughter in the memoir, you've made public things that were very personal, I guess, particularly like the letter that she wrote about, about what she wanted done with her body after death. Did you have any qualms about printing the letter and about sharing certain things about Paula's life?
No, not really. At the beginning, I wrote this book without the intention of publishing it. It was meant for her. And when later, as the family and I decided to publish it, it was maybe time to edit and take away some things. But every time I tried to do that, I had the feeling that I was betraying the book. So I just left it as I had written it in the first place. And I don't think that it's offensive in any way for Paula. She was a very private person, but she was also a teacher. And I think that this long and painful agony, this experience of life and death, is something that is so rich in its content that many people can find in the book a space where they can get in touch with their own losses and separations and with the celebration and joy of life. And Paula would have liked that.
Do you feel like you've emerged from this any more fearless about death?
I don't have any fear of death anymore. I didn't have a lot before because I didn't contemplate death at all. I, like most people, I thought that it was not going to happen yet. And I never imagined that one of my children would die. So I had not a personal worry about death. After this experience, I lost the fear of death because I understand that it is not the opposite of life. It's a continuation of life. And I know that nothing that I can do to protect or to control the circumstances will change the destiny of my children or my grandchildren or myself or my mother or whoever I love that may die before I do. I am not afraid of death. And when you lose the fear of death, there are very other few fears that you have. So in a way, I have become stronger. I feel liberated.
Before we end our conversation, I guess I'd like to just ask you if there's anything you'd like to add.
Well, maybe one thing that we should say is that, you know, during that incredible year, it was a very intense time. Many things happened that were extremely dramatic. And one of them was that my granddaughter, Andrea, was born in the same room where Paula died 6 months later. So I had the opportunity to see both events, death and birth, in a contained space in a very short time. And I learned a lot with those two experiences. I had the impression that both were made of the same fabric, that Andrea was coming to the world with pain and difficulty, not carrying any memories from where she had been before. And I had the impression that the mother was like a door, and I was pulling this baby through this door from another world into this world. In the same way, 6 months later, I was in bed holding my daughter, walking with her to a threshold, and trying to cross that threshold with her to see what was life there as it had been before for Andrea. You know, that the feeling that life is a station in a long journey of the soul. That was so clear to me with those two events that happened that year.
Isabel Allende, her new memoir is called Paula. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, telling the story of Japan's picture brides. We talk with writer-director Kai Ohata about the women who were brought to Hawaii from Japan to marry Japanese laborers. Many women were duped into marriage. Hata's new film, Picture Bride, recently won the Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival. This week, it opens the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he's fascinated by how jazz can acquire a foreign accent. Kevin was recently in Holland. He'll tell us about the sound of Dutch jazz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A new drive is underway to promote the nomination of Dr. Henry Foster as Surgeon General. President Clinton has reaffirmed his support for Foster on the eve of his confirmation hearings. UPI's Carol Van Dam prepared this report.
The White House admits it's going to be an uphill battle when Dr. Henry Foster begins testifying tomorrow before the Senate Judiciary Committee to become the nation's next Surgeon General. Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole has said he opposes Foster's confirmation. Nevertheless, White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry says President Clinton remains confident Foster can succeed if senators give him a fair hearing. Foster first came to the attention of the administration for his fight against teenage pregnancy, but the focus quickly shifted to the issue of abortion when Foster gave conflicting numbers on how many abortions he performed as a gynecologist obstetrician. Carol Van Dam, The White House.
Secretary of State Warren Christopher says cutting the last economic ties with Iran will show the world that the United States is determined to stop Iran from backing terrorism. President Clinton says the United States will cut all economic ties with Iran to protest this and Tehran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. Christopher says the decision could cost thousands of U.S. jobs and millions of dollars in profits to American firms. Washington is also trying to persuade Russia to cancel its plan to sell nuclear reactors to Iran. The topic is certain to be touchy when President Clinton meets Russian President Boris Yeltsin in Moscow next week. Tickets to the 1996 Olympic Summer Games in Atlanta have gone on sale today. From Peach State Public Radio, James R. Groves has more.
The Atlanta Committee for the Olympic Games will release about 36 million brochures throughout the country today. They can be picked up at selected grocery and Home Depot stores. The brochures contain ticket information and mail order forms and a listing of each Olympic sport. For now, tickets are available only through the mail. Next year, phone and box office sales will begin. Orders received in the first 60 days will be put in a pool and will be selected in random order. Those received later will be processed on a first-come, first-served basis. About half of the more than 500 Olympic sessions are expected to sell out. Ticket prices range from $6 for an early round baseball game to $636 for the opening and closing ceremonies. For National Public Radio, I'm James R. Groves in Atlanta.
Republican congressional leaders could soon announce their strategy to reform Medicare. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says he's joining House Speaker Newt Gingrich in a new approach to the matter. Their new plan would look at Medicare separately from the drive to balance the budget. Dole told ABC yesterday it'll be tough to do this without cutting Medicare, but he says the system is facing bankruptcy and needs to be reformed quickly. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow fell about 5 points to end at 4,316. Declines led advances by a small margin in heavy trading. This is NPR. May 1st is celebrated as International Labor Day in several countries. The Chinese government has used the occasion to implement a 40-hour work week. NPR's Ted Clark reports from Beijing.
In China, workers often spend far more than 40 hours a week on the job. By restricting employees to just 40 hours, authorities hope to spread the available work around to more people. China's facing a major unemployment problem because millions of farmers are seeking work in towns and cities, and because inefficient state-owned enterprises are laying off large numbers of people to become more profitable. The 40-hour work week is not a hard and fast rule, however. Companies facing production deadlines and companies involved in seasonal work will be granted exemptions. And even those workers who are held to 40 hours are likely to take on second and third jobs, a growing trend in China's rapidly privatizing economy. This is Ted Clark in Beijing.
The wives of two men jailed in Iraq say they visited their husbands in a Baghdad prison. The women's visit yesterday is the first contact that William Barloon and David Daliberti have had with any outsiders in 2 weeks. The men were arrested in March after straying across the Iraqi border. They have been jailed for 8 years each for illegally entering the country. Linda Barloon and Kathy Daliberti arrived in Baghdad after a 12-hour trip across the desert from Jordan. They're pleading for their husband's freedom. A seventh juror has been dismissed from the murder trial of O.J. Simpson. The reason for the dismissal is not known. The excused juror is a 25-year-old flight attendant who'd asked to be dismissed more than a week ago. She's been replaced by a 28-year-old female Latina who's an appraiser for the L.A. County Assessor's Office. The move now reduces the remaining alternates to five. It's estimated there could be months more of the trial. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Kai Ohata is the director and co-writer of the new film Picture Bride, which won the Audience Award at the Sundance Film Festival. This Wednesday, it opens the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema. Picture Bride is based on a little-known chapter of Japanese-American history. The film is set in Hawaii in 1918, where Japanese immigrants worked the plantations for low wages. Hata is Japanese-American and lived in Hawaii until the age of 6. Both of her grandfathers were Buddhist ministers. Her father was a minister turned entrepreneur. He sold souvenirs to tourists in Hawaii. When the family moved to New York, he opened one of the first sushi restaurants there. I asked Kayo Hata to explain what a picture bride was.
Picture bride is actually an extension of the arranged marriage. As you know, or you may not know, in Asia, the arranged marriages are very common. Marriage is very much a matter of the family. But during the early 1900s, primarily between 1907 and 1924, a lot of immigrant men were overseas and they couldn't afford to go back for a wife, and thank God for photography, they were able to send pictures of themselves, and the women were able to send pictures of themselves, and they were able to make matches that way. And so they became known as picture brides in America.
I guess one of the things I really want to know is, why would a young Japanese woman want to come over to Hawaii to marry a man that she'd never met?
Mm-hmm. Most of them came from very poor farming backgrounds, and this was part of it was economic necessity. And their families couldn't afford to support them anymore, and this represented a really great opportunity to earn money for their family and to come back wealthy. And I mean, this was of course part of the dream that was promoted by, you know, immigration recruiters. Also, I think a lot of these women, I like to think of them as being really on the cutting edge of women of that time. They were the real adventurers. And aside from economic necessity, I think a lot of these women just wanted to have an adventure. I mean, during this period, how many women were able to really travel across the ocean and see the world? And the other thing is that, you know, as in the in Japanese families, once you marry a man, you have to live with their go to his household, and one of the most dreaded aspects of marriage was of living with your mother-in-law. And so a lot of these women often cited, you know, not having to live with their mother-in-law as another compelling reason.
The picture bride in your movie wants to go back to Japan after she gets to Hawaii because she doesn't like mm-hmm. life on the plantation. Her husband is older than she thought he would be. Was this common? Did a lot of the picture brides who you interviewed
Oh, yeah.
really want to go back to Japan, or at least for a long time do they want to
oh,
go
yeah.
back?
Oh, yeah. For a long time, many of them really regretted having made the decision. They came over with paradise in mind, and instead they got, you know, a husband who's much older. And instead of this very romantic image that their husbands had pictured for them, they got the cane fields, and they just felt incredible homesickness. And many of them talked about wanting to go back for many years, and I think it was only until their children came and they started putting down roots in Hawaii and they really saw the other side of life. But initially, that was the dream. They just wanted to go back.
For the women whose marriages worked out, what did they think of marriage as being? I would guess that their idea of a happy marriage would be a little bit different than, say, the typical American's idea of a happy marriage in 1995.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things is just that the husband was very honest and hardworking. He didn't drink or gamble because it was so common for these plantation laborers to drink and gamble because they had led such a wild bachelor life before these women came over. So that was one of the most dreaded aspects of coming over, is that their husband would be a drunk or a gambler. But so if he didn't drink or gamble, that was already, you were doing very good. The romance part of it, I'm not sure if they had so much a concept of a romantic marriage. By the 20s, because of movies, I think maybe they started to, and especially with women from the city, they were more sophisticated and they knew that there was this thing of called romance, and they were affected by Western notions of courtship. So I think that's why in the film I tried to bring a little bit of that in, where the country boy has to court the city girl in order to connect with her.
My guest is Kayo Hata, director of the new film Picture Bride. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Kayo Hata is my guest, and she's the co-writer and director of the new film Picture Bride. Is there a story you were told by a former Picture Bride that really stuck with you that you included in your movie Picture Bride?
Well, the climax of the film, which I don't really want to give away, but of the baby dying in the Cane Fire, that was something that many women that I talked to recounted for me over and over, what a dangerous place it was for mothers and their children. They could not keep an eye on their children, and as they worked, that was their main concern. And when I heard that story, it really epitomized just like what daily life was like for these women.
The sugar fields were burned at the end of every season?
Right. The sugar is in the stalk of the cane field, and so they would have to remove the leaves. And originally it was done by hand. They would pull the leaves off the cane stalks, but they found a quick way of doing it, which was to burn the leaves. And huge fields would be set on fire, and it's an amazing experience watching a cane field fire. It's like the noise and the heat. So you can imagine it's not exactly the safest place for children to be playing near these fires, but there were a lot of accidents.
How did you set the fire for the film? I bet you hadn't worked with fire before.
No, that was a real challenge. The first time that we attempted to do it, the sugar company that we, the sugarcane plantation that we were filming on was still in operation, and they didn't want us to burn up their crops because that's money. And so we had to kind of do a fake fire with propane torches and do a fake wall of cane fields and cane field plants. And when we got the rushes back, instead of this menacing fire that we needed, it looked like a little barbecue. I mean, people were running around screaming and there were two little tiny fires and it looked ridiculous. I mean, it was, we looked at each other and said, this is not going to work. I mean, this is supposed to be the climactic scene. And instead, they look a little bit silly. And so we had to reshoot that scene. And thank God for Miramax, when they came in, that gave us the luxury of going back and doing these reshoots.
How did you reshoot it?
We ended up actually burning a real cane field. We went to Hamakua, which is a big island, and that plantation had been shut down, and they gave us an overgrown weeded, a cane field that was completely covered with weeds, and they said, you know, it's all yours, you can burn it. Again, though, we had difficulty because it had been raining quite a bit, and you don't do cane burning when it's wet. they wait for the driest season. But we managed to get a pretty decent-looking fire out of it.
Your film ends with a long list of credits of people who helped to fund the film. Some of those credits are in memory of, people donating money in memory of somebody.
Right.
And I'm wondering how you got that many people behind your film.
Well, this film is really unprecedented. A film like this had never been made about Hawaii. It's an independent, it's only like the second independent film coming out of Hawaii that has a long history of, you know, Hollywood films coming there and episodic television. So the community in Hawaii was really excited. It was like, this is a homegrown project, you know, local girl makes good, and the producers were women, and all the people working on it were from the islands, and this was a way. You know, most people in Hawaii have plantation roots, so it was like, okay, this is really exciting. We're gonna bring our past to the big, to life on the big screen, and so it was really an outpouring of support from the community who just wanted to see it done. And I think partly is the timing too. A lot of the cane fields are closing. The sugar cane fields are being converted to golf courses, and a lot of the companies, sugar companies, are closing down. It's really becoming a way of the past, and so I think it was that sentiment, that nostalgia for wanting to capture something that was disappearing for the younger generations, and so it was amazing. We call it kokua, is a Hawaiian word for generosity and help, and it was amazing kokua on the film.
In your film Picture Bride, the plantation workers go on strike.
Right.
And there's a scene in which they're all singing a song in protest against the boss.
Right.
Was that a real strike song that you found?
The Hole Hole Bushi. No, that's a song that I made up, but it was inspired by real-life songs that the women used to sing in the fields while they were working. And this was one of my first connections to the souls of these women, when I heard actual recordings of retired plantation workers singing the song. A man in Hawaii, his name is Harry Urata, he went around to all the different Hawaiian islands, and he recorded these songs called Hole Hole Bushi, and they were very poignant, very funny, raunchy songs that they composed on the spot, and they're kind of like the slave songs of the South, and it was call and response, and it was based on a Japanese melody. Very simple, but the first time I heard it, I realized, boy, there's a lot about Japanese women that I don't really know. Some of them were so raunchy, you know, come out, you know, there was one of the songs would come out and visit me, my husband's going to be out watering and we'll have a good time, you know, or the other one was, and then they're very, very passionate songs as well. One lyrics talked about how my love for you, she's singing to her husband, my love for you is stronger and burned hotter than the fires of Halemaumau volcano. And the first time I heard those songs, I thought, wow, this, like, you know, the whole stereotype of reticent, quiet Japanese immigrant women is totally went out the window. I realized that there was a lot more to them than I knew about. So I really wanted to infuse the women in the film with that same earthiness and life that I found in these songs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Kayo Hata directed the new movie Picture Bride, which she co-wrote with her sister Mari. It opens the Philadelphia Festival of World Cinema this Wednesday. This is a 1965 recording of a song that used to be sung in the sugarcane fields.
Hawaii, koko de wa yo, jikan ga ta yori, omae.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll have a look ahead at the confirmation hearings for Dr. Henry Foster, the president's nominee to be Surgeon General. Joanne Silberner will be telling us about the nominee, who's become pretty controversial. Also on today's program, a story from Mara Liasson about President Clinton, the Congressional Republicans, and Medicaid. And also on today's program, we'll be hearing about a man in California who lent his prized collection of jazz photographs, some of them autographed, to a local college. And we'll tell you what happened later in the program.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, says he's fascinated by how jazz can acquire a foreign accent and still be jazz. He's been spending a lot of time in Holland, where he's researching a book about Dutch jazz. Kevin says the Dutch version is the most interesting transplant he knows. We asked him to tell us about it.
Drummer Han Benink and pianist Misha Mengelberg on Mengelberg's arrangement of Thelonious Monk's Crisscross. They just taught you your first two lessons about jazz in Holland. One, the Dutch worship Monk. Love those thorny tunes, love his clunky piano. Two, the Dutch know how to swing. If you think Europeans have a problem with that, get over it. Musicians growing up in Holland learn to play an instrument, not a particular musical style. The Dutch I know downplay their own musical traditions. So it's no surprise the Dutch took to jazz, where you use virtuosity to express yourself. Still, they don't worry much about musical purity. They'll mix up Monk, Stravinsky, three-chord rock, anything, and make it sound like real music, not a pastiche. For jazz, Holland is an alternative musical universe. You may recognize the sources, but the proportions are all out of whack. That's saxophonist Paul Termos and the Termos Tentet, with a rethink of the 60s classic Woolly Bully, called Sam the Sham Was a Pharaoh. To me, that sounds very Dutch. Clean playing and an excitable eighth note rhythm, deadpan and funny at the same time. That guttural saxophone language is very Dutch too. Jazz horn playing has always been speech-like. Think of Ellington's wah-wah trumpeters. And Dutch improvisers naturally, maybe even unconsciously, echo the way they talk. Dutch is a harsh language on first hearing, filled with congested consonants and tricky vowels. One Dutch tongue twister, which means 88 beautiful canals, goes Achtentachtig prachtig grachten, or something like that. That language, the scene's compact size and relative isolation, and a few key players who've worked in various bands, all help generate a distinctive accent. Even non-Dutch players who settled there pick it up. Composer Sean Bergen was born in South Africa, but he's lived in Amsterdam for 20 years. You can hear African echoes in his writing, but he sounds Dutch anyway. Thank you. Postmodern American composers who juggle different styles like to cut from one to another. The Dutch tend to slide sideways, more dreamlike. If you follow modern classical music, you know the Hague School centered around composer Louis Andriessen. It influences jazz and vice versa. A few members of the chamber group Orchestre de Volharding used to play in Willem Broker's zany big band. Andriessen himself sometimes works with acrobatic singer Gretje Bijma.
Het groet als een pet.
En muggen erboven ingewanden als leerten.
Jazz and classical folks have been mixing their genres for decades, but in Holland, musicians are less neurotic or pretentious about it than elsewhere. We started out making the case for the Dutch as swingers, but generalizations are always tricky. Bassist and composer Martin Altena doesn't swing, by choice, he says, but his late 80s band of improvisers brought jazz inflections to his music anyway. The Altena Octet was a striking combination, the sound of jazz bleeding off into some new dialect. In a second, you'll hear his octet with a solo by the American expatriate Michael Moore on alto sax. He's a lyrical player who sounds like he's gone native here. I'd say more, but there's no time. Dank u wel. Goeiedag.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. He's currently working on a book about Dutch jazz. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Alan Tu, Nancy Updike, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Our interns are Zeb Esselstyn and Sienna Chrisman. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.